What happens in the classroom to the child? What kinds of activities is my child going to be subjected to on a regular basis? You hear a lot of talk about values clarification, and there's a lot of controversy about it, but people don't always understand what's wrong with it. You know, that those promoting it say, well, we're just trying to help our children to understand their values. I want you to think of your mind as a computer. You've all heard the lifeboat story, right? You know, there's 10 people in the lifeboat only holds 9. Who are we going to throw out of the lifeboat? And if I told you that story, all of your minds would start thinking, who am I going to throw out of the lifeboat? The first time I heard the lifeboat story, I was a grad student. My degree's in special ed, so I'm a ringer. And I said to the prof, well, we're not throwing anybody out of the lifeboat. We'll throw a rope out of the back of the lifeboat and somebody swims for in a 1 hour shift. There's only ever 9 people in the boat and everybody only swims 3 hours a day, an hour at a time. He said, there's sharks in the water. I said, there's a shark bag in the boat. And the conversation ended. But I was a ringer. Because I knew that he had controlled the universe. He said, who are you going to throw out of your lifeboat? So all of your minds, because that's how all of our minds work, there's the box and there's where we go. Who are you going to throw out of the lifeboat? If I had said to you, come up with a solution to save everybody, you would have thrown a rope out the back of the boat. You would have turned the boat upside down in the water because it's more buoyant, put the baby on the top of the boat. Everybody cling to the boat, no problem. Everybody take off all their clothes because at this point nudity is a little not real important when we're saving a life. Throw out everything not necessary in the boat. We bail for so many hours. I've heard hundreds of suggestions. If I had said to you, save everybody in the boat. But I didn't say that. I said, who are you going to throw out of the lifeboat? And so your mind went right over here. Just like a salesman says, do you want it on your Visa or your MasterCard? He gave you a choice, didn't he? Is no one of the choices? Would you like a red car or a blue car? Do you want that in 10 days or 30 days? You always get a choice, but I control the universe of choices. That's how various clarification works. If I control the universe of choices, I can mold someone's behavior. And they always think that they thought it up by themselves because they didn't realize that I controlled the box. That's why values clarification is wrong. Because it makes the child think that they made up their own mind when they really didn't, because I gave them some very concrete guidelines inside of which they had to make up their mind. And it's a very valid way of changing a behavior.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the show. Today you're going to learn more about who and what that was, but first I want to read an excerpt from John Taylor Gatto's book, The Underground History of American Education, to properly set a tone for today's show. This is from page 39. Meanwhile, at the project offices of an important employer of experts, the Rockefeller Foundation, friends were hearing from Max Mason, its president, that a comprehensive national program was underway to allow, in Mason's words, the control of human behavior. This dazzling ambition was announced on April 11, 1933. Schooling figured prominently in the design. Rockefeller had been inspired by the work of Eastern European scientist Hermann Müller to invest heavily in genetics. Müller had used X-rays to override genetic law, including mutations in fruit flies. This seemed to open the door to scientific control of life itself. Müller preached that planned breeding would bring mankind to paradise faster than God. His proposal received enthusiastic endorsement from the greatest scientists of the day, as well as powerful economic interests. Müller would win the Nobel Prize, reduce his proposal to a 1,500-word geneticist manifesto, and watch with satisfaction as 21 distinguished American and British biologists of the day signed it. The state must prepare to consciously guide human sexual selection, said Müller. School would have to separate worthwhile breeders from those slated for termination. Bear with me, folks. Just a few months before this report was released, an executive director of the National Education Association announced that his organization expected to, quote, accomplish by education what dictators in Europe are seeking to do by compulsion in force, unquote. You can't get much clearer than that. World War II drove the project underground, but hardly retarded its momentum. Following cessation of global hostilities, school became a major domestic battleground for the scientific rationalization of social affairs through compulsory indoctrination. Great private corporate foundations led the way. 30-odd years later, between 1967 and 1974, Teacher training in the United States was covertly revamped through coordinated efforts of a small number of private foundations, select universities, global corporations, think tanks, and government agencies, all coordinated through the U.S. Office of Education and through key state education departments like those in California, Texas, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and New York. Important milestones of the transformation were, number one, an extensive government exercise in futurology called Designing Education for the Future. Number two, the Behavioral Science Teacher Education Program. And number three, Benjamin Bloom's two-volume Taxonomy of Educational Objectives, an influential manual which in time impacted every single government school in America. While other documents exist, these three are appropriate touchstones of the whole, serving to make clear the nature of the project underway. Take them one by one and savor each. Designing Education, produced by the Education Department, redefined the term education after the Prussian fashion as, quote, a means to achieve important economic and social goals of a national character, unquote. State education agencies would henceforth act as on-site federal enforcers, ensuring the compliance of local schools with central directives. Each state education department was assigned the task of becoming, quote, an agent of change, and advised to, quote, lose its independent identity as well as its authority in order to, quote, form a partnership with the federal government. The second document, the gigantic Behavioral Science Teacher Education Program, outlined teaching reforms to be forced on the country after 1967. If you ever want to hunt this thing down, it bears the U.S. Office of Education contract number OEC-0-9-320424-4042, and then in parentheses, 010. The document sets out clearly the intentions of its creators, nothing less than impersonal manipulation through schooling of a future America in which, quote, few will be able to maintain control over their opinions, unquote. An America in which each individual receives at birth a multipurpose identification number, which enables employers and other controllers to keep track of underlings and expose them to direct or subliminal influence when necessary. Readers learn that chemical experimentation, that is in quotes, that was in this document, on minors would be normal procedure in this post-1967 world, a pointed foreshadowing of the massive Ritalin interventions which now accompany the practice of forced schooling. The Behavioral Science Teacher Education Program identified the future as one in which a small elite will control all important matters, one where participatory democracy will largely disappear. Whatever. Children are made to see through school experiences that their classmates are so cruel and irresponsible, so adequate to the task of self-discipline, and so ignorant that they need to be controlled and regulated for society's good. Under such a logical regime, school terror can only be regarded as good advertising. It is sobering to think of mass schooling as a vast demonstration project of human inadequacy, but that is at least one of its functions. Postmodern schooling, we are told, is to focus on pleasure cultivation and other attitudes and skills compatible with a non-work world. Thus, the socialization classroom of the century's beginning, itself a radical departure from schooling for mental and character development, can be seen to have evolved by 1967 into a full-scale laboratory for psychological experimentation. School conversion was assisted powerfully by a curious phenomenon of the middle to late 1960s, a tremendous rise in school violence and general school chaos, which followed a policy declaration, which seems to have occurred nationwide, that the disciplining of children must henceforth mimic the due process practice of the court system. Teachers and administrators were suddenly stripped of any effective ability to keep order in the schools, since due process apparatus of necessity, a slow, deliberate manner is completely inadequate for the continual outbreaks of childish mischief all schools experience. Now, I know Gatto's characterization of what's going on here might be a little bit troubling, but again, bear with me. Now, without a time-honored ad hoc armory of disciplinary tactics to fall back on, disorder spiraled out of control, passing from the realm of annoyance into more dangerous terrain entirely, as word surged through student bodies that teacher hands were tied. And each outrageous event that reached the attention of the local press served as an advertisement for expert prescriptions. Who had ever seen kids behave this way? Time to surrender community involvement to the management of experts. Time also for emergency measures like special education and Ritalin. During this entire period, lasting 5 to 7 years, outside agencies like the Ford Foundation exercised the right to supervise whether children's rights were being given due attention, fanning the flames hotter even long after trouble had become virtually unmanageable. The Behavioral Science Teacher Education Program, published at the peak of this violence, informed teacher training colleges, under such circumstances, teachers had to be trained as therapists. They must translate prescriptions of social psychology into practical action in the classroom. As curriculum had been redefined, so teaching followed suit. Third in a series of new gospel texts was Bloom's Taxonomy, in his own words, a tool to classify the ways individuals are to act, think, or feel as the result of some unit of instruction. Using methods of behavioral psychology, children would learn proper thoughts, feelings, and actions, and have their improper attitudes brought from home, quote, remediated. In all stages of the school experiment, testing was essential to localize the child's mental state on an official rating scale. Bloom's EPIC spawned important descendant forms, mastery learning, outcomes-based education, and school-to-work business collaborations. Each classified individuals for the convenience of social managers and businesses. Each offered data useful in controlling the mind and movements of the young, mapping the next adult generation. But for what purpose? Why was this being done? Hey, everybody, and welcome to School Sucks Live. Today is the 18th or 19th.
19th.
Yeah, of July. Hope you're enjoying your summer. I'm Brett. Tonight on the show, we're going to be talking about a very interesting story. Seems like one of those easy set them up and knock them down kinds of stories where the Texas Republican Party has released their platform for 2012, and they've come out against critical thinking. But could anything really be that simple? No. And spoiler alert, this story has no protagonist. But before we get into all that, very excited with me tonight is Corey.
Hello.
Hey, Corey.
How's it going?
Glad that you're back. Also in the studio tonight, you can see him. You're like, who is that lady? Her name is Allison. Hi, Allison, and welcome.
Hi, it's great to be here.
You are from Canada.
Yes, sir, I am.
That's a different country.
It is indeed.
So you've been here before, though. We met at Pork Fest, I think, a couple years ago.
Yes, I was at Pork Fest 2011, and I didn't make it this year, but I had a blast last year.
Excellent, excellent. And with you, right next to you, is Mandrick, old friend of the show.
Hey, what's going on? I wasn't here last week. You guys missed me, didn't you?
We did okay.
Yeah.
We had a really interesting talk about behaviorism in video games. You used to be a big Warcraft player, right? World of Warcraft?
Yeah, I had accounts that I had sold, and I've done the MMO thing, and I've played in video game tournaments all my life, but I've that ship has sailed. I'm pretty much done with gaming.
We largely talked about Warcraft the whole show.
Oh, wow,
week.
That would have been a great show for me.
Well, what we were talking about was behaviorism,
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
how, you know, just like B.F. Skinner's behaviorism, the guy who did the rats in the box.
Oh, yeah. That's all the game is.
Punishments and rewards.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so we found an article on Cracked called 5 Creepy Ways That the Games Get You Hooked and Keep You Playing. Something to that effect.
Oh, I've seen that article before. Yeah, that's an old one, yeah.
Paraphrasing a little bit. But I have a feeling that the theme of behaviorism might be coming back into the show again tonight.
Could be.
This story, somebody sent this to me, and at first I was like, ooh, that's gold. For the kind of stories that we look for, I'm not a big fan of bad news, but I thought this one, the headline really grabbed me. Then I realized it's negative thing about the Republican Party, which is fine. Most true news probably is relatively negative, but came from a very liberal newspaper that I don't think they did their homework. Or once we really get into the meat of this story, it's possible that they might have purposely avoided some facts.
Mm.
So tonight, we're going to start with this story. And this is a jumping off point. We're going to see how deep this actually takes us. But it's called Texas GOP Declares No More Teaching of Critical Thinking Skills in Texas Public Schools. Still, again, this just sounds too easy. The Republican Party of Texas has issued their 2012 political platform and has come out blatantly opposed to critical thinking in public schools throughout the state. If you wonder what took them so long to actually state that publicly, it is really a matter of timing. With irrationality
now the norm, and an election hovering over the 2012 horizon, the timing of the Republican GOP announcement against critical thinking instruction couldn't be better. It helps gin up their anti-intellectual base. Oh, my goodness. This is such hack.
My high school newspaper editor would have returned that article to me if I had turned it into him. It's so clearly biased.
Yeah. Now, I don't know what Truthout is. I'm sure if we looked at their recent articles, we could get a lot of information about what kind. But I think just from reading one paragraph, you know, if you've got relatively decent information literacy skills, you get a pretty good idea of where they are coming from. Yeah. So you're right. High school newspaper, this would not pass. They would be like, you need to learn a little bit about journalism.
Yeah.
You ninth grader. The Texas GOP's declarative position against critical thinking in public schools, or any schools for that matter, is now an official part of their political platform. It is public record in the Republican Party of Texas 2012 platform. And I looked at the link. I got a PDF of their platform. It, sure enough, it is in there. But
you read the entire platform?
No, I didn't read it. It was long, but I looked at, you know, their positions point by point on education. With regard to critical thinking, the Republican Party of Texas document states knowledge-based education. This is in quotes. Knowledge-based education. This was one of the headings. We oppose the teaching of higher order thinking skills. And they have in parentheses values clarification. Another thing we should talk about. Critical thinking skills in similar programs that are simply a relabeling of outcome-based education or mastery learning, which focus on behavior modification and have the purpose of challenging the student's fixed beliefs and undermining parental authority. Ooh, like I said, there's no protagonist in this story. But we've learned some new vocabulary right there. Outcome-based education. Now, what is outcome-based education? Sounds good, right? Doesn't it sound kind of pragmatic?
It just sounds so obviously like a euphemism that I can't even begin to guess what it might
actually
mean. Yeah, what
outcome? What possible outcome are they talking about?
Oh, I mean, you mean
even
like,
if you totally fail, like I could have failed out of high school, that would have been an outcome.
Right. Yes. So, yeah, Mandrick brings up an interesting question. Who decides what outcomes are desirable?
And how are they defining critical thinking here? What does that mean to them?
I think that's the
rub. Does that mean the same thing that it means to us? I don't know.
I don't think it does.
Well, no, because what they're saying, what the Texas... I'm sure the Texas Republican Party, if you told them what like critical thinking actually is, they'd be like, yeah, let's not encourage any of that. I mean, any political organization or political party does not benefit from a population that actually thinks critically. So I would say that real critical thinking, real intellectual self-defense, all of these people would be against it.
Yeah.
You know, that doesn't benefit them.
And what are fixed beliefs also? That's another thing. Like
religious beliefs.
That's what I figured. Right. And the state, right? All those.
So what they're worried about, what my assessment of this is that the Texas Republicans, who are probably very Christian, are worried about the progressive. See, like liberals think schools are controlled by conservative interests and conservatives think schools are controlled by progressive interests. And people who are above all that think that schools are controlled by state and status quo interests.
Yes.
Right. So they just direct it to one side or the other, depending on who their opponent is. But what I think their fear is that progressives who are, you know, Jesus hating sodomites are going to. Now, that's.
Did you just call me a progressive?
No. What I'm saying is that from their point of view, they think that they're trying to take Christian values out of school.
Oh.
Right? And they're trying to undermine parental authority to insert, their progressive ideas. Now, this has a lot of truth in it. Because what is this outcome-based education? Where did it come from? And what is it supposed to do? Now, your question was about outcomes. Who decides them? So outcome-based education began in really, it's had different forms and different names, and that's what they're stating in this document here. They're saying this is just a relabeling. It's a euphemism. Like when you said, Mandrick, what's critical thinking skills? Well, critical thinking skills is a euphemism for outcome-based education, which was a euphemism for basically behavior modification.
Right.
So they keep relabeling the same thing that they're trying to do.
So what's the root?
So
the root of this, I think it's in the 60s, but go ahead, Corey.
Well, I was just going to say that, I mean, inflammatory headline aside, you know, the guy who wrote this or the person, I don't know if it's a guy, the person who wrote this article knows their core audience. And I think they're not against critical teaching skills so much as they're against something that's being passed off as critical thinking skills, not teaching.
Absolutely. Yeah, the progressives who read the site, they're probably like, yes, yes, great.
I knew it.
No research. 843, join SSP if you have something relevant to this topic. We will be back in a couple minutes. This is School Sucks Live. Hey, everybody, and welcome back to School Sucks Live. I'm Brett. With me tonight, Corey Allison from Canada and Mandrick from Greece.
I'm not from Greece. I'm
from Greece.
Straight
and
from Greece.
From the Broadway revival of Greece, where he played Rizzo.
I did.
We started out tonight's show with what would seem like something that we could make short work of if the subject was really just that simple. It was an article from something called Truthout, which we've discovered very quickly was some kind of progressive publication. It was called Texas GOP, that's Grand Old Party, the Republican Party, declares no more teaching of critical thinking skills in Texas public high schools. But a couple paragraphs into that, we discover this term, new vocabulary term for many of us. It's something that I probably only mentioned on the show a couple times in the past, called outcome-based education. Now, what are these outcomes? And I found this article written, it's actually a transcription of a speech given by John Taylor Gatto in Vermont. And he's certainly my go-to historian for government school history in the United States and beyond. And by beyond, I mean, you know, into Central Europe where the Prussian system was, and that's what our system is based on. We've talked about that plenty on the show. I'm alpha testing the new website now, so I've just put in all the content.
Uh-huh.
Basically, I've been uploading and putting all the content I've ever produced, video, audio, into this new website. And I'm interested to see, you know, working through keywords, what Gatto will turn up if somebody types that name into a search. I think it's going to be a lot of shows because he's been mentioned all over the place.
Absolutely.
Gatto, Prussia. Yeah. But this was a speech that he gave in Vermont, and I wanted to share some of this with you. Let me start with the Designing Education for the Future papers. They were the collusion with the Federal Education Department and presumably the independent state agencies. They redefined education after the 19th century Germanic fashion as, quoting from the document, as a means to achieve important economic and social goals for the national character. These people love euphemisms. And I would hasten to add that none of those goals included the maximum development of your son or daughter. State agencies would henceforth, quote, act as federal enforcers, ensuring compliance of local schools with federal directives. So guys, we're talking about centralization, more kids under the control of fewer minds of central planners. The document proclaimed that, I'm quoting again, each state education department must be an agent of change. Proclaimed further, change must be institutionalized. I doubt if an account of this appeared in any newspaper in the state of Vermont, or in that matter, any newspaper in the country. Education departments were, I'm quoting for a third time, to lose their identity as well as their authority in order to form a partnership with the federal government. All aspects of government, I think we see people making this deal with the devil at the state level, you know, and at the local level. You see the police even getting all of this money from the feds, and they get toys, and they get, what do they get?
Tanks. Bearcats.
Right.
Yeah. To go after things that the federal government wants pursued from a law enforcement standpoint.
Right.
So they lose a lot of local control. I mean, this is kind of like how things get centralized. This is how more power winds up in fewer and fewer hands. You do handouts, some kind of reward. Everyone's into these rewards.
Sure.
Right? And avoiding punishments. We've been educated to be that way. So they say, here's some rewards for your compliance with federal mandates. And they do these things and they get these toys. And I think that seems like what happened with the Department of Education as well. Mandrake at Porkfest, right before you came on,
yeah,
we had a public school teacher, a woman named Pam, who...
Yeah, I was there. I was listening to the interview. Sure.
So she was talking about how she felt like she, who's a generation beyond any of us, got a much better education in the 1960s before the federal government completely took over the public school system, you know?
Yeah, I could see that in the public school setting, but we have the internet now.
Sure.
We just have to know, you just have to know how to use it and what to look for.
So yeah, so it's kind of irrelevant at this point. Yeah. And what I asked her, I said, was, you know, basically compared to what? You know, compared to what mm-hmm. kind of we only can compare public school education to public school education. But I think her point was valuable. Maybe they were actually getting a superior, even though there's still all kinds of problems with it and still based on this Prussian model. They were getting a superior education because it wasn't so much about the scientific management of people. I think it still was, but obviously these people learn from their mistakes and learn from their failures. Like bureaucrats on like the actual service level, like they might not, like the woman at the DMV, I don't think she goes home and says, oh, I gotta be faster tomorrow. So many people in line looked unsatisfied. But the people who are higher up, you know, who are more about implementing these controls for the entire population, they probably look at the things that don't work and they say, back to the drawing board, we can do better. And we talked a couple weeks ago about Peter Thiel and, you know, the technocratic management of society. And as the decades have gone by, and you make a good point about the internet for us, but all of that great technology, the state has it too, and they're, you know, scheming and plotting ways to use it.
And to take it over.
Absolutely.
Which they never will be able to.
No, they can't. Like it's the cat is out of the bag already as far as the internet is concerned. That's true.
But it is important to point out that they will always go back to the drawing board. That's my point. They say, oh, you know, the father of psychology, a guy named William Wundt, who probably was very influential in the setting up of the schools in the late 1800s, early 1900s, that gets exposed. They switch to John B. Watson, the first behaviorist. They switch to Skinner. All this stuff gets exposed. They say, okay, now it's called outcome-based education, and we're very concerned about outcomes. We like outcomes. And people say, oh, outcomes, that sounds pragmatic. It sounds like you're focused on...
You do anything, and there's going to be some sort of outcome.
Successful or unsuccessful.
That is absolutely true. So I just want to give you another paragraph. And if you have thoughts or knowledge about what we're discussing here, you want to join the conversation, it's 843-JOIN-SSP. One more paragraph from Gatto. The Behavioral Teacher Educational Project outlines specific teaching reforms to be forced on the country, unwillingly, of course, after 1967. It also sets out, in clear language, the outlook and intent of its invisible creators. The impersonal manipulation through schooling of a future America in which few will be able to maintain control over their own opinions. This is School Sucks Live. We'll be back in a couple minutes and we'll pick it up there. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to School Sucks Live. I'm Brett. With me tonight, you can see him on the screen there. If you're watching at a schoolsucksproject.com/live, from left to right is Corey. He's the one kind of swaying back and forth. Then those two folks who are kind of close together on the left is Allison. Look at that smile. And on the right is Mandrake. And tonight, we started out talking about a story. Sounded like a fun story, but it goes to very dark places.
It really sounded like a slam dunk.
Exactly. The Texas Republican Party speaks out against critical thinking skills in their 2012 political platform. Then we discover that their idea of critical thinking skills is not, you know, what we talk about on this show, but it's a euphemism for something called outcome-based education. which is a euphemism for controlling how young people think using the techniques of people like Wilhelm Wundt, B.F. Skinner, and John B. Watson. Basically, the idea that people are animals that can be trained by dangling rewards and sometimes, you know, threatening them with punishments. And people will try to avoid punishments, and their behavior can be controlled and modified that way. So, speaking of behaviorism, we were talking about John Taylor Gatto right before we went to break, something he wrote, or something that a transcript of a speech that he gave in Vermont years ago, the Behavioral Teacher Educational Project. I just want to start this quote from this paper in 1967 one more time. Nothing less than quoting again, the impersonal manipulation through schooling of a future America in which few will be able to maintain control over their own opinions. An America in which, quoting again, an individual receives at birth a multi-purpose identification number which enables employers and other controllers to keep track of their underlings, unquote. Underlings is my interpretation of everything else that came out of this document. Quote, and to expose them to the director's subliminal influence of the state education department and the federal department acting through those whenever necessary. So this is pretty pretty grim stuff that we're talking about tonight. And what Gatto has gotten into is, we know, and we've talked about this on the show for a long time, that all the way back in the first half of the 19th century, if you're maybe you're just discovering us and you don't know this, so I'll go over it real quick. Public schooling was set up in Prussia, which later became the Weimar Republic, which later became Nazi Germany, to basically control soldiers. In other words, when soldiers on the battlefield, when the Prussians were trying to expand their kingdom and fight the French under Napoleon, some people would exercise common sense and self-preservation and drop their weapons and run away. Well, this isn't good for the elites and the, you know, the royals. You need to be willing to die. So they had to teach them to be respectful of the state, respectful of authority. Horace Mann, a famous phrenologist in the middle of the 1800s, phrenology is the science of determining a person's personality characteristics by feeling the bumps on their head.
They had a special device.
Sounds legit.
Yeah.
Celestina saw one once at a medical museum. They actually put it on her and ran the machine. It told her like what career she'd be best suited for based on the bumps on her head.
Yeah, I found that a lot of these phrenologists were a lot of these behaviorists and people who would be accepting of that kind of psychology,
right,
were also into phrenology, the bumps.
Yeah.
What can you learn from a person's bumps?
Well, apparently her ideal careers, I believe, were Zeppelin attendant and pugilist.
That's a boxer.
Yes.
They never updated the careers, apparently, from the 19th century.
Wow.
So, Mann, somehow just through connections and being kind of a slimy politician-y type, comes to be in charge of the Massachusetts Board of Education. He goes over and he observes many education systems in Western and Central Europe. He falls in love with the Prussian system. He wants to bring it back to America. It is exposed in the middle of the 1800s as this sick, manipulative, controlling system. And he says, this is how he defends it. He says, well, if they can use it to push that kind of a state, that kind of a society, we could certainly employ it to maintain our wonderful Republican institutions. And by a small R Republican, like living right in a republic. So that was how he justified it. And it, again, expanded into the 20th century with John Dewey, another education reformer who liked the idea of using education to plan society. Like, look, people don't need to be so smart because we need people who can work in factories. So what's not important, like highly educated people, that's not what we need. What we need are people who are somewhat competent, but above all, predictable and compliant.
It's like Huxley's Brave New World. That's what it reminds me of.
Oh, sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So his idea was that instead of training people not to throw down their weapons and flee the battlefield, they were training people to not say to themselves, wait a minute, this factory job sucks. I'm quit.
Right, right.
Because
exactly.
Everybody hates their job and just suck it up. That's what we're taught.
Well, I mean, all of this stuff, and before they had the scientific management of people, they used the church, mm-hmm. was all about getting the behavior, controlling behavior, and getting the outcome, back to outcomes, mm-hmm. that were preferable to those in power.
Right.
So I understand how when first people first encounter this stuff, it's easy to say, ah, conspiracy, you're crazy. But it would be kind of foolish. It would be kind of crazy for the controllers to not try to implement these systems, especially in societies where people are told that they're free.
Right.
You can't tell millions. When you're like thousands of people, or even at the top, top level, hundreds of people, you can't tell millions of people that they're free and not right. control how they think.
Right. You can't convince them they're free unless they have a skewed definition of what freedom is.
Absolutely.
A little asterisk, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Free asterisk.
And after school, I mean, after that experience for 12 years, what wouldn't seem like freedom?
You can justify anything Seriously. After that. I mean, they do a pretty good job.
Yeah. I mean, well, the thing about outcome-based education, like I said, you know, at the very beginning, it sounds so much like, you know, an obvious euphemism that it's the words themselves are practically useless in telling you what it means. And the outcome they're talking about, my first thought about outcome-based education was, it was all about standardized testing and how well the students performed. It's not really about that at all. The outcome they're talking about is not for the students' benefit. It's for the benefit of central controllers.
It actually made me think of one more part of this article or this transcription of Gatto's speech. According to the Behavioral Teacher Education Project, more from that, postmodern schooling would focus, I quote directly from the document, on pleasure cultivation and interpersonal relationships and other attitudes and skills compatible with a non-work world. It makes sense, of course, doesn't it, that irresponsible, semi-illiterate people could not be trusted with much responsibility. So in the new change agentry schooling, which is called for by this national teacher training document, the teacher is a therapist, translating the prescriptions of the social psychologist into practical action research in the classroom. This is another thing that I've talked about on the show extensively, is how the school, I hate to say it, but actually has become like this lab for a lot of these drugs that exist for the purpose of behavior modification. Mm-hmm. And when the drugs exist, it seems like then they come up with the disease, like oppositional defiant disorder.
ADHD.
Or ADHD. Any of you guys ever told you had anything like that when you were in school?
No.
Nothing like that.
I've heard people say that or... But it's really just like, well, maybe if I was interested in what I'm... It's like, how comes the things I'm interested in, I don't have a problem being attentive?
Four of us should go to Manchester West High School tomorrow and just try to sit in a class and see if we can get labeled.
We get labeled as crooks,
pervert.
Pervert.
Loner.
Yeah.
This is School Sucks Live. If you want to join our conversation, the number is 843-JOIN-SSP. Skype in School Sucks Live. We will be right back. Hey, everybody. This is Brett, and welcome back to School Sucks Podcast. We're coming to the end of our first hour. Boy, time flies on this show. With me tonight, from left to right on your screen there, if you're watching our stream, is Corey, Allison, and our old friend Mandrick. We've been talking tonight about outcome-based education. You know what's interesting, guys?
Yes.
We haven't even defined fully what it is yet. And outcome-based education... Simply put, I'm just going to give you a very user-friendly definition.
The no BS.
Right. Was the repackaging of the same kinds of behavior modification that probably originated with the Prussian school system in the early 1800s, where the people who were running the system wanted to have these outcomes that they found desirable. You could call them progressive. They wanted to take the focus away from academics and away from what they would say things like, we want to get away from rote learning, and we want to get more into how kids feel about the subjects. But what they were trying to do was they were trying to basically extract information to better employ for behavior modification.
I don't know if you necessarily want to talk about this, but I'm really curious. Like, how do they get it to work so well, like from the top down? like all the different levels. Like what you worked in this public school system, sure. Brett. So like, what did you hear that you were like, oh wow, this is such a great way to teach children? Or
it's just an obedient profession. I mean, like most professionals are very obedient and they respect authority. And we learn that from a variety of different sources. I mean, it comes from home, it comes from family, it comes from church, it comes from school. And most people, when they say, well, you know, I'm the authority in this situation, they don't say, well, you know, that's a bunch of crap. They say, oh, yeah, you should have just said that in the beginning because I really had some doubts about what you were saying, but I didn't know you were the authority. But now that I know that.
Because they already went through the training themselves. You know?
Yeah, I mean, I remember even working in private school being yelled at for, like, jumping the chain of command, mm-hmm. you know, going above your supervisor to ask a question, or, like, if your supervisor wasn't giving you the answer or wasn't willing to help you with something the way, you know, you thought was most beneficial. If you jumped, if you went too high in the chain of command, the person you went to would be like, you don't talk to me about that. So most people, by the time they're done with 12 years of school and maybe 4 years of college or maybe a master's program, I mean, you just get beaten down and beaten down and beaten down into obedience, into conformity, and that results in like real intellectual apathy where people are like, oh, thinking is so much work when I just have these authorities. Or the fine people at, what was that publication? Truth Out. Where our story began tonight. Like, oh, this guy will write articles and just tell me how I should think. Or I'll read the New York Times. I'll watch Fox News. I don't need to be thinking for myself. So it's a good question, Mandrick, because it seems like so impossible. How could things be implemented like this? But it just... People don't ask questions.
Behavioral conditioning also really works.
Yeah.
You know, Skinner's theories, like, you know, it works on rats and it works on people. I'm not, I'll say it's a terrible thing to, a terrible method to use to educate children, but I'm not saying it doesn't work. It really works. And by the time you get to the end of school and you're thinking about, you know, maybe you're becoming a teacher, you've spent your entire life spending all day, most of the days, with people who, you know, any decision they make could affect you the rest of your entire life.
Right.
And that continues through college and through, you know, and then, you know, into the job. There's always somebody around who, you know, has basically, you know, whether your life goes well or poorly in their hands.
Absolutely.
Well, at least they lead you to believe that. Oh, go ahead, Ellie.
Right. And it's not only the students, though. It's also the teachers who've been through the same system
right.
and are also indoctrinated in the same way. So they're not used to questioning the system either.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I think my point was in the beginning. It's an obedient profession. Psychology, right. Psychiatry, those are obedient professions.
Mm-hmm.
They are very easily managed from the top down because people do not ask questions. But a lot of people don't know what they're involved in. I mean, you have to think at this point for you to ask that question, what's presupposed there is that one of these teachers says, wait a minute, what's going on here? I might want to talk to somebody about this. This doesn't seem like it's right. And then they go to the authority and then it's explained. And then they say, oh, well, you're the authority. From my experience, the people that not only the people I worked with, but the people I trained to be teachers, they wouldn't even... I don't mean to be cynical, but a lot of them wouldn't even get to that step. They would just say, oh, well, I'm a teacher. That's a noble profession.
Sure.
You know, and they would never look at it any closer than that.
I would have loved to have been there from the start just to see how it all, you know, like how this system fell into place.
I would say that it was probably less coherent than we make it out to be sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people want to rule the world, but how efficacious they are, how much impact they really actually have. Like, it's fun to sit around in a dark room and make a plan. But, you know, there's a lot of variables
that come into
play. You know, like we look at, like, think about books like The Creature of Jekyll Island. Well, that one worked.
Yeah.
That was a good one. You know? But it doesn't always go that way. And this is what leads them back to the drawing board. Mm. You know, oh, well, we can't call it behaviorism. We can't call it Skinnerianism or whatever. Skinnerian. I've heard Skinnerian.
Sure. Skinnerian.
Skinboxism.
So we can't call it that. We can't call it behaviorism. Let's call it outcome-based education.
Sure.
So in the early 90s, there was a group of parents in Pennsylvania who started to investigate this. I wanted to play like a 3-minute clip on the show, and hopefully after that we can take some calls about that. This is I'm going to have to apologize for some choppy audio quality here. This is a VHS tape that has been transcoded for YouTube. I think this is from 1991, 1992. It's called Who Controls Our Children? I highly recommend the whole video. It's about it's actually only about an hour long. And this woman who wrote a book about outcome-based education discusses her findings at what I believe is actually a school board meeting. She's on a stage, so it's a big one.
Somewhere in Pennsylvania.
Yep. But this is, Mandrick, you're from Pennsylvania.
I'm from York, Pennsylvania.
So you, your siblings, and your mother could have been subjected to some of this.
Probably.
Let's take a listen. We're going to go for about 2 or 3 minutes. After that, hopefully we'll take some calls. This is Peg Luksic. It's called Who Controls Our Children? And she starts talking about outcome education, its three goals, and then some samples from one of the tests they use to see how well what they're doing is working.
That first of all, someone has to set a standard for what is mastery of this goal. How good is good enough? How much self-esteem is enough self-esteem? How much adaptability to change is too much adaptability to change? So first, we have to set a standard. Second, I have to test you in some way. I have to do an assessment to find out if you met my standard. Third, I have to remediate you. If you don't meet the standard, I have to bring in a curriculum or an activity or a program that will in some way change your behavior to make you meet my standard.
Now, one of the interesting things about this is that nobody fails. Mm. You know, everybody, no child left behind in outcome-based education. So because the outcome, what is desirable to those in power, is so important, it's what this education is based on, you will be remediated. If you fail, there's no way out. You go back and they put you through this curriculum again, which is not about anything academic. It's about modifying behavior. So these Republican idiots from the beginning of our show, their objections will start to make a little bit more sense once we hear a little bit more about outcome-based education.
Now, when you look at Pennsylvania's goals, we asked, what standards do you set? How do you test? How do you remediate? The state's response was, well, we're not real sure about that. So we went looking to see, well, what are you doing right now? Well, right now, Pennsylvania gives a test and has since the 1960s. It was called the Educational Quality Assessment, or the EQA. It was given.
So the Educational Quality Assessment is the name of the test. We will pick that up when we come back in a few minutes. We would love to hear from you. 843-JOIN-SSP. We'll be right back. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to School Sucks Live. I'm Brett, and with me tonight, look at these people. Corey, how you doing?
Great. How are you?
Good. Good. Allie?
Hey.
Allie or Allison.
Hi.
Hi. Thanks for coming again.
It's great to be here.
It's great to have you here. And Mandrick.
It's even better to have me here, as always.
We are talking tonight about something called outcome-based education. I'm really excited about this topic, even though it's very dark and kind of scary. But it is some new vocabulary for us. And I'm sorry, I think you're hearing some Skype sound. So I'm going to try to deal with that in just a minute. But in the last segment, we were talking about something called Who Controls Our Children, a movement that was started in maybe the late 80s, early 90s. And one of the people motivating it was a woman named Peg Luksic in Pennsylvania, who started investigating what outcome-based education was all about. And we were going through a video clip. I wound it back about 15 seconds. And she's going to explain a test that students in Pennsylvania were taking. This test was being used for over 20 years, I think about 25 years in the state of Pennsylvania. And we're going to look at some of the questions on this test and what are considered right and wrong answers on this test called the EQA.
Each district took the EQA. It was given in grades 5, 8, and 11. Districts were required to write their long-range plan from the results of the EQA test, the Educational Quality Assessment test. In that plan, each district had to say how they were going to change their curriculum in order to make the children do better on that assessment the next time. Now, if you think about it, that makes sense. You know, if you give the same test in every district, and I give it in your district and your district and your district, and you were first and you were second, but I'm sorry, you were last, what are you going to do? You're going to change your curriculum so you're not last anymore, because that's embarrassing. So the EQA was the basis for curriculum planning for all the districts in the state. And it was a mandatory test. The districts had to take it because they had to base their long-range plan on it in order to get their state money.
Their state money, right? Mm-hmm. The state gets money from the feds. The districts get money from the states.
That's the carrot.
They hang the centralized control at the state level, which gets its directives from the federal level. Everybody takes this test. That's how you get your funding. Those are the strings attached that are actually chains.
What did the EQA test? The EQA tested first the 10, then the 12 quality goals of education. When we looked at the EQA, parents thought it was testing reading, writing, self-esteem, citizenship. It tested locus of control, whether you are an internally motivated person or an externally motivated person, whether you stand up against a crowd, whether you go with the flow. And they scored it. There was a right answer to the attitude questions.
So this is not testing academics. It's testing attitudes and values, right? And it has outcomes that the creators of the test at the Department of Education find preferable.
Right.
The right answer was go with the flow. In citizenship, the EQA said it did not test anything in the factual domain. It didn't matter if you knew what the United Nations was. It didn't matter if you knew who the president was or what a president was. Citizenship tested thresholds of behavior. How do I vary reward and punishment to make you do what I want you to do? Sample question. There was an organization called the Midnight Marauders. They went out at midnight and spray painted all over everybody's walls. I would join the group if, A, my best friend were a member of the group. Child could say yes, no, or maybe. The correct answer was yes. I would join the group if all the popular kids were members of the group. Yes, no, or maybe. The correct answer was yes.
The second one was I would join the group if popular kids were all members of the group. The correct answer was yes.
Popular? That's like elected officials or teacher, like, right?
It's like, well,
they're pretty popular.
It's like the crowd.
Right, right.
Yeah.
I would join the group if my parents would ground me if they found out. The correct answer was no. You are supposed to avoid punishment, but you are supposed to honor commitments to friends and go with the group. The goal was collectivism. The EQA tested for adaptability to change. What parents were told was, well, you know, our world is constantly changing, and we want people who are going to be able to go with that and survive that. We don't want rigid people who can't cope. Sounds very reasonable. The EQA tested and scored for rapid emotional adjustment to change without protest. That was the state desired response. The EQA just didn't test the attitudes of children. It scored the attitudes of children.
I mean, at this point, for me,
profoundly disturbing.
It's not really surprising, but it is disturbing.
So if you took Peg Luxick and this organization or this movement, Who Controls Our Children, this outreach project in the early 90s,
right,
at face value, and she wrote a book about outcome-based education around this time as well, and you never knew any of this, you would be shocked.
Right.
I would have to think that most parents, if you tried to share this kind of information with them, they would call you. I mean, what do people do? How do they bat that away? You're a conspiracy theorist.
Yeah. Right.
It's an isolated occurrence, that kind of a thing. So we're going to continue with this subject. There's a few different angles that we can pursue it from. We would also be interested in hearing from you if you have thoughts on behaviorism or outcome-based education. This is School Sucks Live, 843. Join SSP. Skype in School Sucks Live. Skype is better than your phone, please. Thank you, if you can. Thank you. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to School Sucks Live. We still have plenty of time to talk to you. With me tonight, we've got Corey, Allie, and Mandrick in the studio. We've been talking about outcome-based education. and behaviorism a little bit, in which outcome-based education has roots. But right now we are going to go to the phone all the way to Australia. We have Nicholas. Are you there, Nicholas? Can you hear us?
Well, there's a massive delay, so apologize for this.
No problem, no problem. We're glad we can talk to you. So what's on your mind tonight? What do you think of all this?
Well, I think the major issue is that the locus of responsibility is still outside the individual. It's like if you use an analogy of like a football game, like a gridiron game or something like that, and you think about like a new rule being brought in and then a team learning how to use that rule to their advantage and everyone else complaining because it's not in the quote-unquote spirit of the game. Okay. And I think that's how people want education to be, like, fair and everyone getting on okay and peaceful and everything. But you can't possibly put that expectation on someone else's behavior. And that's why we end up with these tests and things, so that we can monitor other people's volition.
Don't you think when we're talking about this outcome-based education, though, don't you think all of this fairness and, you know, turning the focus away from grades, I mean, this sounds like the kinds of things that some people would want to hear. And I really just see it as a mask for the same thing, just to reiterate, a new way of modifying behavior using basically what is an old set of techniques.
I think that's right. And it's like I was saying, there's a surface level and there's an underneath level. And so the surface level is the rhetoric, which is what you're saying. But underneath that, there's something quite sinister going on because people don't want to take responsibility for their own actions.
Right.
I mean, my master's is in behavioral studies, so
okay.
Should know a lot more about it than what I do. But I think people want to have someone to blame. They want to have an antagonist, but there really isn't one. I mean, it's like when we were talking about Hegel a while back, he can be painted as an antagonist, as can Wundt or Skinner or any of these people, Watson. But the reality is that we still have free choice. And if you look at Max Weber at all, the problem is not that we have free choice, but it's also that we have to make a choice. And that's where people are falling down, in my opinion.
So you think people want a scapegoat? You think people want to say, oh, well, there's nothing else we could have been. This is deterministic because we're forced into this education system. I mean, I think what's scary about it is most people will never feel like they actually have that choice. Or when people are confronted with these arguments from authority or threats of force, those kinds of logical fallacies, they don't even see that a choice is there. And breaking that stuff down, understanding that because something comes from an authority or a so-called expert, it is not automatically valid. I think that's the work that's important. But I think most people, like, part of what the system does is it removes the knowledge, the awareness that a choice even exists.
I don't know what you mean, and I completely agree with that. But I also think that there's a false sense of security that I go to school every day and there's so many questions that aren't asked about me. I mean, it's like you were talking last week about entrepreneurship. If you go to school and tick all those boxes, then you can just cruise through life and let things slide. But as soon as you question it and as soon as you do that, you have to take so much more responsibility for your choice, for your life, for your decisions. But that's where the empowerment comes from, and that's why we have scapegoats, and that's why people want to blame other people so that they don't have to take that responsibility. Again, only my opinion.
Plus, it's really difficult. I mean, a lot of people don't want to admit that maybe they went through something and it was a waste of their time, or maybe they're presented with these new ideas and it's just like, I don't even want to challenge that, because then that would just say that all of what I've done so far is just for naught or just for the wrong reasons. I mean, it's tough to admit that, right?
Can I bring in a popular culture reference?
Yeah, I like popular culture.
Love it.
Yeah, Nicholas, go ahead.
Okay, so Batman The Dark Knight Rises has just been released, right?
Yeah, should be out here in a couple of days, I think.
Okay, well, I recommend everyone who's at all interested, go and see it. It's not great as a Batman film, but as an analogy for society, it's brilliant.
Can you give us just a...
No.
No, no.
We have to flip it.
No, oh,
no.
We have to think of it.
All right, so no...
No summaries. But
no summaries, no spoilers.
Differently, in the sense that school wants you to be successful. Everyone wants you to be really successful in life and get a good job and earn lots of money, but you have to look at the areas where you failed badly, and that's where you learn the most, and that's where the opportunities, the vistas open up to do something unique and cutting edge. And that's why, I mean, it's Brett, you said it, the younger you can start being an entrepreneur, the better, because you do have to spend time sleeping in your car and eating out of, you know, dodgy restaurants and things like that.
You don't necessarily have to go.
And that's what
that.
It's in this new film, Batman fails. He fails badly.
Nicholas, there is our music. It is always good to hear from you. Thank you very much for the call and for sharing your thoughts and your knowledge on this subject tonight. I'm sure you and I will talk again soon. This is School Sucks Live, 843 join SSP. We still have time for your call. You can Skype in School Sucks Live. We'll be right back. Hey everybody, welcome back to School Sucks Live. This is Brett with me in the studio tonight, Corey, Allie, and
Mandrick.
Yeah. Thanks for being here, guys. Interesting topic, dark topic, and we hope that we've put some new vocabulary in your arsenal for approaching people about this very difficult topic of the government school system and the psychological destructive impact that it has on young minds. I've been saying almost now for 3 years. The three-year anniversary of School Sucks podcast is coming up in just a couple of weeks.
The podcast?
Yeah. And I think I've been saying pretty much that whole time that sometimes people understand why this happens, you know, this conformity, obedience, intellectual apathy. It seems like it could just be the natural product of a very unnatural environment, right?
It seems like it.
Yeah. But then you look at the social planning of people like John Dewey, social planning of people like Horace Mann, the Prussian system, and you see that some thought went into it, but we see tonight that this is an ongoing project. Things like zero tolerance is a good example of trying to, you know, really bizarre ways of controlling behavior.
Right. Turn the brain off and...
Yeah, you know. Yeah. And that speaks a lot to the obedience of the people who are working in this system as well, who just enforce ridiculous rules because they're the rules, and well, you know, we follow the rules,
and that's what they'll say that. That's exactly what they'll say. It's like, well, you know,
those are the rules.
If you don't like it, you should go to the school board and get these changed, and blah blah blah.
If they say
school
that.
Board can't change that. It.
Yeah.
That's like the nicest response you'll get.
Yeah,
like well, you know, I think I was telling you, Brett. I think I may have even mentioned this on the show before about. My one experience I had in high school, my junior year of high school, I was taking physics, and I didn't do homework, ever. I just didn't bother with it. And I was acing every test, so I was obviously learning the stuff, but they graded you just for participating in the activity of doing your homework. Whether you went, you know, whether you did it well or poorly, it was a part of your grade, and I just didn't do it. I could have all sorts of, like, justifications for why I didn't do it. Ultimately, I was... Technically, yes, I was lazy. But it came to a point where I was trying to prove a point.
I don't think that was lazy.
Well, I mean, I didn't do it.
There's different ways
at
to learn
the time,
something, right?
That's true. And I had learned it. That's the thing.
Okay.
I learned it. And they finally, at one point, sent me to the guidance counselor's office to speak to the guidance counselor, who heretofore, my only involvement in them, had been dropping by, being asked to their office once in a while, and saying, hey, did you pick a college yet? No, I didn't. Thanks. See you next time. But, you know, what they told me was they asked me why I wasn't doing my homework. And I said, well, you know, the idea of homework was to reinforce what we learned in class, practice what we learned in class. So when test time came, I can pass the test. I don't need to practice. I've aced every test, so I don't need to practice. That's why I don't do homework. And then they told me, the guidance counselor told me flat out that the purpose of homework is not to practice what you learned in class. The purpose of homework is to, you know, learn how to take instruction and do what you're told.
Wow.
Yeah.
They just came right out and said it. It's not about what you learn or what you know. It has nothing to do with what you learn or what you know.
Follow
it's all about shut up and do what you're told.
That is outcome-based education. I mean,
she even told me, like, when you get out, when you're grown up and you're on your own and you're working at a job and you tell your boss you don't want to do a certain part of your job, you'll get fired. So, like, am I going to get fired from school for not doing my homework? Please?
No. It's true, though. It's obedience in those, you know, those big corporate jobs. I mean, I saw it.
Oh, sure. I mean, and that's an entirely different thing.
Sure.
Yeah.
But it does take advantage of all the lessons we learned in school about how to just shut up and do what you're told and don't make waves.
Yeah.
Try not to be noticed.
Yeah, corporations are more than happy to have taxpayers fund the training of their labor force.
Mm-hmm.
Not just in, like, basic skills, but also in, like, how do you behave in your cubicle as well. So just jumping off on what Corey said, giving us a more anecdotal example of outcome-based education, I wanted to share from the authorities, the decision makers in outcome-based education. This is from an article called Outcome-Based Education Explained by Ron Sunseri, and he actually wrote a book about this subject. Proponents of OBE make the seemingly irresponsible claim that all children can learn everything, right? But what does that mean? Because at the core of transformational outcome-based education, one doesn't find a core of academics. That's exactly what Corey was just talking about. Mm-hmm. This seems too absurd to be true, but consider the statements of two OBE proponents, Professor Anthony Oettinger from Harvard, who says, "The present traditional concept of literacy has to do with the ability to read and write. But do we really want to teach people to do a lot of sums or write when they have a $5 handheld calculator or word processor? Do we really have to have everybody literate reading and writing in the traditional sense? Did you ever think you'd see the day when a Harvard professor would suggest that writing and math aren't important? Couple this with the following quote, where we see the interests of business specifically represented. Thomas Schticht." It's a guess on the pronunciation. Looks like you were supposed to move your mouth like that.
Schticht. Our whole German viewership is
German.
Wow. I tried to say German and viewership at the same time, so it ended up being a hate crime. Sorry.
Thomas Schticht, professor and senior scientist, Applied Behavioral and Cognitive Sciences, Incorporated in San Diego, California, is a member of the U.S. Secretary of Labor's Commission on Achieving Necessary Skills. Euphemisms. He says, many companies have moved operations to places with cheap, relatively poorly educated labor. What may be crucial, they say, is the dependability of a labor force and how well it can be managed and trained, and not its general educational level. Although a small cadre of highly educated, creative people is essential to innovation and growth. Ending discrimination and changing values are probably more important than reading and moving low-income families into the middle class. So,
everybody but those low-income families agree with that.
Yeah, it just the nerve of people like this who think that they are smart enough or special enough to plan the lives, you know, the outcomes of the education and the lives of millions of people that they've never met and they know nothing about, while they're shielded from reality in some university office teaching 9 hours a week.
The thing that really that confuses me about it is that if this is their model of education for everybody, then who's going to be smart enough to centrally manage this stuff a couple of generations from now? If everybody went through the same outcome-based education program for their entire education career, as it is.
People who go to Choate. People who go to Phillips Andover.
All right, fair enough. Know? Yeah.
I don't agree with a lot of the things that he wrote about, but there's a really good educational critic named Jonathan Cazole. Mm-hmm. He was a very, very liberal guy. But he talked about the inequality in education, how some were clearly being educated to be dumb, and some were being educated to manage the dumb.
Mm.
That's called Shame of the Nation, I think. This is School Sucks Live, 843, join SSP. We will be back in a couple minutes. We have one more segment, and that means time for your call. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to School Sucks Live. This is our last segment of our regular show.
Aww.
Our regular show is the live 10 to 12 show. At 12, we start something called the After School Sucks Special. That could go to
What's that all about?
Woo!
Could go to one. It's an adult show.
Oh, yeah?
And we really, it's a fun thing for us to do.
Well, that sounds interesting. I can't wait.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if it would exist if you weren't one of the hosts of the show.
It would not exist without me.
That makes sense. So the After School Sucks Special is a time where we can, if we're really in the middle of an educational topic, when we're having a lot of calls and we have a lot of aspects of the story to still explore, we can continue after midnight, or we can talk about whatever people want. And usually this is where people want to be exploratory with their conversation. So that's what the After School Sucks Special is all about. It's bonus content on the new website, which I have been alpha testing over the past few days and uploading, like I said before, just about every piece of content that I've ever recorded. It's been a lot of work, and I'm looking forward to getting some additional content to the people who have been subscribing to the show. If you have been listening and you enjoyed the show tonight, if you've watched and said, boy, that looks like a lot of work, consider going to schoolsucksproject.com/support, and you can click a link there and see some subscription levels. We ask for $6 a month, and there's a lot of additional content that you can get access to that way. You can see videos of all our live shows from 10 to 12. You can see full videos of all the after shows. You can download MP3s of those shows. You can see School Sucks home movies, some very exciting home movies, a film that I made called Mr. Sushi Rice Man Goes to Work. I'm in it. It's
How have
not
I
in.
Never seen this?
I've never seen it either.
I'm intrigued.
It costs $6 a month. So that will be available very soon. And I really appreciate the pioneers in that effort. Right now it's 85 people. Thank you very much. You've signed up to contribute on a monthly basis, $6 a month, the School Sucks, to keep this project going. It means so much to me, considering that this live show investment was about $1,500, countless hours of time to make all of this stuff actually work. And it doesn't still work perfectly, so that means more of a time investment. But I really I appreciate everybody who's been on board from that, even though you're not getting anything back other than, you know, new content every week. It means a lot to me and a lot to the team here, the team
Woo.
At School Sucks Project. So we had this call from Nicholas in Australia, and I really appreciate what he was saying. It's easy to talk about a lot of these people, Wilhelm Wundt, B.F. Skinner, Edward Bernays, John B. Watson, Horace Mann, John Dewey, Barack Obama, as villains, right? Now, this is a show for me that is really about self-ownership, responsibility, and personal empowerment. And it's very easy, once we start looking at the writings of some of these people, to get sucked back in to where, Corey, you were saying, where we started the beginning of the show with Republicans and Democrats throwing turds at each other.
Yeah. I would just have to look at my Facebook feed, and like half the people from that I've known for years and years, half of them are out there going, well, you know, that's the liberals that are screwing everything up. If we just get rid of Osama Obama or whatever their cute nickname for him is, just get rid of him and Barney Frank and all of their types, then, you know, we'll be fine. And then the other half are saying that it's the Republicans who are screwing everything up.
Yeah.
And they're both right is the best part.
Yeah.
They're both absolutely correct at the same time.
They also have some increasingly sophisticated language for brown people are bad and rich people are bad.
Oh, God.
Depending on which side
you're
talking about. Some kind of brown or some kind of rich, you know, and they villainize them as well. So I appreciate Nicholas's call in pointing out that we need to continue to rise above that stuff. It's easy to do, especially when you're doing a live show and you're, you know, switching cameras and being mindful of breaks and trying to make sure that your co-hosts are comfortable. It's easy to lose sight of some of that stuff. Do you got any of you need a drink or
anything?
Could
you rub my back, sir?
I can't right now from here.
I'm pretty comfortable right now.
Good. I'm glad.
I'm perfectly comfortable.
So I think that pretty much brings this topic full circle. Anything that we missed, I can add to the podcast. So
it was a great follow-up to last week's show.
Yeah.
Where we talked all about behavioral conditioning and video games. And this is just the same kind of behavioral conditioning on a much, much bigger scale.
Yeah. I mean, and this also works for advertisers.
Sure.
Works for marketing, works for like corporate obedience, like we mm-hmm. were talking about. So the state bleeds into what we usually consider the market quite a bit. And that was the example with video games last week.
Mm.
But this was a clever new trick for the central planners and controllers of society. Because when I was in school, there was this real dichotomy and conflict and debate between behaviorism and what they called constructivism.
Right.
Now, behaviorism was rote. People are animals. You can train them. They want to get rewards and avoid punishments, and their behavior will conform to those needs and goals.
Right.
So you can condition them and mold them based on these principles. Well, in the 60s and the 70s, they started talking about something called constructivism, which was more student-centered. So this was the big debate when I was in college learning to be a teacher. Should we be more student-centered or should we be more behaviorist? Or, and some people were like, well, can you blend the two? Well, it looks like they did, right? Because outcome-based education masquerades as a more enlightened form of classroom management, saying that the child is the focus. You know, grades aren't so important. Academics aren't so important. What we're concerned with is feelings and getting to know the child. And let's not focus on, did you pass or did you fail? Let's talk more about, you know, are your parents beating you?
Right.
You know, how does this story make you feel? Are your parents beating you? You know, kind of thing. You know,
have your parents stopped beating you yet?
Exactly. Exactly.
And how much money do they make, right?
Right. And also, they need to know how much money your parents make.
So, yeah, but I mean, this was a really interesting thing because it was, you know, had this facade of constructivism, this more enlightened form of education that's focused on the child.
Right.
That's no longer the teacher is the star of the show.
And it's about guiding the children towards learning something.
Right.
Like not telling them what to learn, but guiding them towards leading to their own conclusions in its purest form.
Right.
As I understand it. Is that correct?
If it really was that, yeah, right. I think so. But you see that they just took the two, they combined it, they took the nice facade of constructivism and used it to continue to modify and control young people's behavior. So some new words for tonight. I hope that is helpful. Behaviorism, even though we talked about it a little bit last week, constructivism, which is the opposite or the opposing position to behaviorism, an outcome-based education. While I don't like to always deal with bad news, I hope that giving people more ammunition for their own pursuits, their own efforts to talk to people about the realities of the state and government school, I hope this is something that you found very helpful. So, I am Brett. Let's go around the room clockwise.
I am Corey. Stay tuned for the after show to learn even more new vocabulary words.
I'm Allie, and I'll be here for the after show.
This is Mandrick. Have a good night, everybody. Don't listen to the after show, please. Do not listen.
SchoolSucksProject.com. If you're listening to us on LRN, please go to SchoolSucksProject.com/live. You can still call in 843. Join SSP Skype in School Sucks Live. We'll be back in 5 minutes. Thanks for listening.
Are they tracking our children? Yes, they are. The tracking now is in something called the Express. This is the Express. It's called the Exchange of Permanent Records Electronically for Students in Schools. This is the information that they compile on the children. This says that any education agency, local, state, or national, can access the data without parental knowledge or consent or notification. The data includes family unit number, all the people in your house, has your child ever been involved with a social service agency, all medical records, includes all performance, includes if they've ever had a behavioral problem, a discipline problem, and gives the receiving agency the name of a contact person and a phone number so they can call back to get more information that is not included in the data bank without parental knowledge or consent. It says that if it goes to a non-school agency, there has to be knowledge and consent. However, if it's going to an employer and the employer says, if you don't sign this, you don't get the job, how many people are going to withhold consent. This is the 1992 Express. Why? Well, if we go back to the New West Learning Center, we go back to the learning styles and the biographical data, and then think about the goals. Ethical judgment, adaptability to change, self-esteem, family living, understanding others, proper environmental attitudes, citizenship, which, remember, the EQA, not factual knowledge, proper role for citizenship. The computer needs to be able to access where your child came from so they know what your child thinks, what your child believes, and how your child learns. That's your learning style. What's the best way to change the behavior? What's the best way to attack the attitude? And serves it back up to the child. Do you see parents on this graph? I don't either. What is the difference between what we had before and what the new regulations are? Before, with the EQA, the state had control down to the district level and could control curriculum planning, which was aimed at targeted subgroups of children. But we had children who did not conform. They said, no, I won't. Outcome-based education does not say the school will teach. It says the student must demonstrate. And through the computer, the control goes down to the individual child. Your child will conform, or they will not move forward. They will meet the goal. So where is it coming from? Where is the driving force? As we started tracing back, what we found was a report called the SCANS, Secretary's Commission on Achieving Necessary Skills. This is the 1992 edition. This was not written by the Secretary of Education. It was written by the Secretary of Labor. Of Labor. And this, I first saw this report in something I got from the University of Pittsburgh when they were implementing and teaching the implementation of the Pennsylvania regulations. And so we went back to the federal government and got the original. What we found is it's not being driven by education. It's being driven by the big, big, big industries. That's who's driving the changes. When we read the SCANS talked all about what we need to have the proper worker of tomorrow. And the children were not referred to as children. They were referred to as human resource material, human capital. Just like, you know, your building and your coal or whatever, your wood, whatever you're making, your capital. And this is business telling education what business needs or wants in the worker of tomorrow. This report says, well, you know, all these things we're talking about here, the necessary skills, this isn't pie in the sky. We're already doing this. And then they gave us a list of the things that they were already doing. One of the lists that they gave us included a contract called WorkLink from Educational Testing Service. This is the resume. This is an electronic computer resume. Jane Smith is pretend. There's her workplace competencies, her interpersonal skills. This is, she takes each test and she has to master the proficiency level, academic. And here's her personal qualities. And she's rated. She only got a good in honesty. Jane Smith is 19. She has not mastered the skills, so Jane Smith is still in high school. This is a high school resume. When I first started debating this issue, I used to say to the press, well, see, this is not the schools will teach, this is the student must demonstrate. So, you know, even if it's a value we agree on, like honesty, should the state be able to set a standard for honesty and test a child's honesty and then deny a child a job or a promotion because they didn't meet the state's honesty standard? It was a joke. And 2 weeks ago, we found there really is an honesty scale.